The majority of the world is not in the city where you live, period. You know, by a fact of billions. So, period. It's you're fishing in a small pond.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Andreas Klinger. Andreas is the head of remote at AngelList. They're the largest remote hiring job board in the world. After building multiple remote teams at companies like CoinList and Product Hunt, Andreas has become one of the preeminent voices in the remote work movement. More and more teams are thinking about going remote. Do we do hybrid? Do we stay co-located for until our Series A and then open a second office? The tools are better and better. So Andreas's experience building remote teams and his lessons learned are really exciting. Also, there is some explicit language in this episode, so if you have any young future software leaders listening, you might want to skip this one. And now, here's my conversation with Andreas Klinger. Andreas, thank you so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You said that you believe in the power of 10 when it comes to getting a group of people together that can accomplish amazing things. What's wrong as you get over 10?
First of all, nothing gets wrong.
Yeah.
I'm always surprised how good small engineering teams can execute if they're structured well. And the more you scale, you obviously inherit more complexity in your team and it just gets harder to manage. You lose more time. People are like more limited. You lose more coordination, communication effort. So in my experience, having like, for example, three teams of each three, you know, and or like somehow structured, like one is alone and like some teams a little bit bigger, and something around the number of 10 is like a very natural number for a small team where you can still be really well aligned. And I think the big magic to scaling companies is actually keeping teams around that size and making it very clear what the different goals and expected outcomes are. And by that, being able to create autonomy, responsibility, and ownership, and be able to scale. And this sounds super easy in theory, and I think there's millions of books and millions of podcasts done about this. It's not that easy in practice, obviously.
So at AngelList, are you working in groups of 2 to 3 in a bigger group of 10? Is that how you're structured?
Yes, at AngelList, I mean... Yes, it's a little bit hard to answer any question around AngelList because AngelList is several different units that work very different in some regard. Like some teams are fully distributed, some teams are hybrid, some teams are co-located, some teams work this way, some teams work that way, right? In the talent team where I'm currently working at is we have small teams that own a complete area and outcome. Basically, it's OKRs. They own a complete area and coordinate between these areas. And each of these teams tries to be as small as possible. So usually it's less than five people, I would say. I think most of them are around 3.
And on that team of 3 to 5, do you have a mix of engineers, designers, and product, or is design and product a level above?
It depends. In our case, we have a mix because we realize that a lot of the stuff is usually facing product. So it's usually you have to have good design and all this kind of stuff. And you have to have a lot of iterations just on design and doing UXR and getting design studies and all this kind of stuff. Like basically getting in front of users as quickly as possible. But it depends on the team. And each team is like working a little bit different here, obviously, you know, and each team most likely can answer that question for their regard better than I would now.
So the heuristic you see is that the more user-facing a team is, as far as the product, the more likely they're going to have a designer and a product manager on that.
Yes. In general, I strongly believe in cross-functional teams, I think, which is kind of the cultural norm right now, so that the team can actually own an outcome and not a function. So that's at least my personal belief. In some teams, I know teams that have... So for example, at CoinList, we had units that where you had like a mix of compliance people, design, engineering, and customer care in one unit that had like one specific outcome, right? And I strongly believe in this kind of setup because that creates a certain sense of ownership is the positive way to frame it, and responsibility, or like if you're in charge, if you mess this up, it's your fault kind of thinking. Like all of a sudden you're like, okay, we have literally, there's no way that I push the ball to the other people and it's their fault now. You know, like you need to figure this out. And I think that creates a lot of clarity and a lot of healthy decision making.
Sometimes I hear outcomes is, we're going to ship this feature by X date. My guess is that's not what you, you're looking for when you talk about outcomes that a cross-functional team can drive. What would be maybe an example of a better outcome?
I think like most people who listen to this podcast know about frameworks like OKRs or like anything related. In my experience, the later stage a product is or a feature is, the easier it is to define quantitative goals. And the earlier it is, the harder it is. So we have very often with early stage features, we have exploration related goals. So basically it can literally be ship that freaking feature, please, you know, like that's the goal. But it can also be have 10 kind of whatever interviews or get feedback from 20 different customers about this. And like, it can be something that's almost soft in a way. It can even be have the marketing launch in ready in time, you know, and so on and so on. In my experience, when it comes to early stage products that can be also like features within a larger product, the quantitative aspects become more like a reality check. It's more like, are we lying to ourselves? This is how you use it. Or like, is there maybe like a potential opportunity, like this kind of reality check? Because the variance in the outcome tends to be that big that you can't really make estimates. The estimate then becomes more of a way of saying, we believe that this needs to be successful, it would need A, B, and C. And even if you don't hit it at that point, you can go very objectively back and see, okay, back then we thought about this in that way, without having this very natural process of you lying to yourself and all of a sudden having like, no, I always expected that 10% increase. I think this is a huge success, you know? Or like it's now it's like 5x and you're like, yeah, 5x is by far too little, you know? But like if you go back and you're like, hey, back then we said actually everything above 50% is amazing, you know? Or like we expected this to go 10x or whatever. This gives you like an objective window into the past. So like as a reality check in early stage, quantitative methods are really useful. In later stage products, I would primarily rely on them, to be honest.
So when I'm really early, it might just be get that feature out or do the interviews that are going to be a leading indicator that I'm going to get the feature right. Later on, I might be, I want to double the conversion rate through this funnel, or I want to, you know, half the time between these two steps.
This is at least my personal opinion on that. Yeah.
I think I've gotten in trouble using quantitative metrics a little bit too early sometimes, and because I really like that.
One interesting aspect here is what I regularly see with teams is using quantitative aspects, for example, A-B testing, to verify stuff they're anyway going to do, which is super dangerous in early stage. So you kind of like, we're doing now an A-B test to launch this one feature, and okay, but like, what are you actually going to change based on that number? Is there any strategic change if this number is this or that? Assuming it's not a complete catastrophe. Like the numbers are never like the polar extremes. They're always like wishy-washy, somehow muddy in the middle, right? So what is the trist, like what are you actually expecting as an outcome depending on that number? Like how is your decision going to change? And this decision is anyway not going to change. Most likely the whole thing you're doing here is much more like a dance of a process that you're doing. It's much more lying to yourself and feeling very cool about what you do than actually doing meaningful de-risking. So the whole job around anything related to quantitative evaluation is de-risking. So if you don't de-risk, if you don't change decisions around that, you know, then most likely you're wasting everybody's time and you're using numbers for internal politics, maybe to feel good about it, whatever, you know, to get external authority, because whatever, your managers don't believe in you, and that maybe it's a valid reason, but realistically you're not doing it for product reasons.
Yeah, the internal reasons don't bring value to the customer.
Exactly.
So let's switch gears and talk about remote teams. So you've written about remote teams, you've worked on remote teams and all their different flavors. You said that remote teams take roughly 5 times the process needs you in a co-located team. Can you talk more about why that is?
So I'm saying 5x. I think the real number is more like 3x, but 5x sounds so cool, right?
Nice and round.
It sounds like really something you can tweet. So I was like, fuck it, I would 5x now. So my thinking here is if I'm five people in an office, I'm like, hey, let's have a meeting. And everybody jumps up, runs into a meeting, is excited about having a meeting, has a meeting, and like, ooh, we're having a meeting, and then decide something and go out. At least this is how I expect most people have meetings, I guess. In a remote team, even with five people, you can't just say, let's have a meeting right now, because maybe Frank is currently not available because he's bringing kids to school, right? Maybe this other person has to leave in 10 minutes. Maybe this other person is currently asleep, So all of a sudden, you need to do crazy things like scheduling meetings in advance, like saying, hey, can we have a meeting tomorrow at 10 a.m.? You need to do insane things like taking notes what was discussed in a meeting, which you most likely wouldn't do if you're five people in a co-located office. It's like, whatever, right? Like, Brian wasn't there. Who cares? Somebody will tell Brian. In a remote team, somebody should take notes, because somebody won't join and it will just be easier to keep them up to date because you don't want to have constantly hangouts with everybody. And this goes on and on and on. Like, you will be more explicit about decisions because you can't constantly double check with everybody because somebody might not be online. So like the whole thinking about process changes, and all of a sudden you don't act like you're five people you don't act like you're five people. You act more like if you would be an office of 20, 25 people. You like introduce processes, structure, workflow. You try to make expectations really clear. You try to make outcomes and decisions really clear. You maybe start crazy things like writing onboarding manuals or tutorials or like all this kind of stuff, And this almost happens naturally in a remote team, but has to happen. And all of a sudden, you're like we 5x the process than within a normal office. The good thing about that, in my personal opinion, though, is it makes scaling a little bit easier because you now can onboard people and they can read meetings. You can have meetings without getting everybody into the room because people can just read those notes. You have onboarding documents that just onboard people maybe faster. So the interesting thing is around a certain scale, and I don't personally know what that scale is, it starts to level off. It starts to become, if you have like 100 people, it's not like you act like you have 500 people. And if you have like 500 people, it's not like you act like you have 2,500 people. It's more like it's levels off at like logarithmically levels off at this stage. And so it becomes like almost like a superpower when it comes to scaling, at least in my opinion.
So you have the kind of framework in place, the structure to scale a little bit before you would need it, and that helps smooth a later scaling.
You're forced to think and structure frameworks around a lot of concepts that you would consider processes, for example, or workflows, but even down to things like trust. You actively need to systemize and structure how you give trust, how you expect trust, how you validate trust, and all these kind of things, which implicitly you would need to do in, I would say, management of digital knowledge workers or management of knowledge workers in general. You need to do that, right, to enable people. But you are almost forced to do that in a remote team if you want to succeed.
So thinking about agendas and meeting notes, that's really easy for me to visualize. Everyone eventually does that, it seems like. This explicitly working through validating trust and giving trust. Can give me some examples of how you've been able to do that? That seems.
It's being aware how you do. It's basically it means good management, right? In a nutshell. But like, what the fuck does good management mean? And I don't have the answer, right? I have my own framework that I'm trying to apply. So it means being able to do and being able to explain how you do decisions. So for example, decision layering. Who in the company makes what kind of decisions? If you join to our team, what kind of decisions do we actually expect you to be able to do week one, month one, year one, right? Like, what do we actually want you to decide? And very often this is like kind of like a tribal thing where you naturally learn that and you just like try to bump the edges, and that works good enough. Ideally, you have at least a rough structured thinking about that and be able to communicate this to new employees as you scale a company, right? The whole framework around here is like, for example, authority. Like, what kind of authority do you get in the team to make decisions? How do you make decisions? And to make decisions, you need to be able to understand how the company values things, how the company values decisions. So, for example, would it be okay for you to just build it, ship it, but only ship it to 1% of the audience? Or is this like, holy shit, the fuck did you just do? We are a security compliance company. You don't do this in our company, right? So in a consumer app, maybe like, hey, fuck, you ship this to 1%, you have these numbers. Holy God, you're the hero of the week, right? Very different cultural values, very different decision-making process, but this needs to be explicit to a team. And through this, you have clear decision-making. Through clear decision-making, you have better being delegation of authority or delegation of decisions. And through that, you're able to systemize at least giving trust, you know. The other end here is validating trust. How do you expect people to deliver outcomes, communicate the goals, like what they actually want to do? All this kind of stuff is classic processes. It goes on and on and on, and I can talk forever. And another thing which I personally like, and this is like the one thing I would like to leave here as well, is processes don't mean big queues of decisions. It doesn't mean 20 people making decisions and like I say something and I pass on to you and you add your stamp and whatever. It doesn't mean this whole complex layering of whatevers, right? Processes means explicit expectations. It means, for example, at Product Hunt, we used to have, and they still have, every morning, everybody does pull request reviews. And the idea is that you do it of everybody. The team is small enough, it's like, I think, 10 engineers or so, that you can still do it from everybody. And you expect it to do it from everybody, at least from people that you work with. That's the minimum, you know. But you do it every morning. And the reason why you do it every morning is that people can rely on that you do it the next morning. This means in a when you push your code in the evening, somebody will have had their morning before you get up, will have had looked at their stuff, and will be able to like give you feedback. The whole idea is here is that you don't need to remind people, hey, can you please, hey, can you please. You don't need to like interrupt people when they do something else and be like, hey, can you take a quick look here? Can you like quickly add your plus one here, which is a huge distraction to everybody. You just push your code and you expect everybody to do it in the morning, and you expect it to do it in the morning before you do anything else, before you answer emails, before you look at your own stuff, because you are unblocking other people. And that's an explicit expectation. That's a process. And this kind of process on this, we would say, level are small enough that people can easily incorporate them, and they are small enough that you can iterate them on. And this kind of processes create, again, trust, you know, and this is the systemization of trust that I think of.
So is that, I heard you talk about kind of onboarding documents. This is what your authority is, week one, month two. Is that kind of, how do people learn that the morning is a time to code review? Is that on your onboarding document?
Absolutely. I think manuals are one of the most underestimated aspects of managing people. They are kind of getting now hip. It's becoming now like more like a thing. But to me, manuals are one of the most under-respected, underappreciated aspects in any team. It gets to the point that most manuals are only updated by the people actually joining because they notice errors. And manuals are one of those things that help you scale, that one of those things that help you make stuff explicit, even to people who are already like longer in the company and are really, really healthy and important, period. Highly recommend.
So what are some of your, what are the things you've learned about? There's a lot of manuals out there that are stale, they're old, they don't reflect reality, they're incomplete. What are some of the ways that we can establish norms that result in manuals that are useful?
Make it explicit what actually is. It's similar to code. When you write code, you want to make it explicit what is debt, like stuff that's no longer updated, you know, and what is actually important and good and like how it works. And the same is with a manual. Make sure that it's rather like remove stuff that is no longer updated, or don't expect people to read it at least, you know, put it in like an archive or something, but make it explicit. Like in case of doubt, we remove everything but 5 articles, and these 5 articles are up to date and you have to read them, right? Rather reduce to things that you actually want people to do and want people to read than trying to have everything there and kind of like find your own adventure game for everybody, right? It's the same with processes. Like with processes, in case of doubt, have less. And at Product Hunt, we used to say we only have like, I think back then it was like 4 processes that we expect everybody to do, you know? And like in case of doubt, have less, but insist on those explicitly, you know, and it's out of that. As soon as you have this, you can like have a fundament where you can build a top. I know a lot of people who love just writing a lot of stuff and telling their employees how they do shit and like how their culture apparently should be, right? And then they leave all these huge documents that nobody a part of them has ever read. What's the point? Like, you're making this to feel good. You're not making this for the team. So what is something that's actionable for the team?
So have the smallest surface area of the manual as you can be functional. Prefer having less than you think you need if that's what you can maintain, because unmaintained documentation is bad. When it comes to that that review process, is this something that you're thinking of, like, I'm going to look at the documentation every week, or is it when I check in code, I need to think about how it impacts the documentation? What's the cadence?
It depends what. Onboarding documents should be owned by people. And you like we had at Product Hunt, we had the expectation of anybody who joins to update them as well, you know? So it's kind of like the first change you do. So Product Hunt has a very aggressive onboarding schedule. And Rado, who you will talk to next week, even made it, in my opinion, more aggressive, but in a very healthy way. So that sounds very contradicting, but we'll hear next week what this means. So one thing that we did is we expected everybody to ship something on the first day, like code, and also change something in the onboarding documents while they still read them. And it was like almost like an explicit expectation. It was like, yes, I know you just joined, you have no idea whatsoever, but like change something. We don't care what it is. You can change the formatting if it improves it, you know? You can fix spelling mistakes, and trust me, I will leave enough for you to fix, you know? You can iterate on something that's not clear. You can add troubleshooting if like whatever is not clear, you know? That's fine. You can add books that you would recommend, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Everything is cool as long as you are at this moment changing it and taking ownership of it in a way. So that was a clear expectation. On the other hand, onboarding docs always had a certain person, usually the engineering manager, being responsible for them, right? And also making clear that what is the onboarding documents they expect people to read, and what is further reading if they want, which are is like obviously potentially outdated.
Gotcha. So we got the required core, engineering manager owns it, new folks are expected to change on the first day, expected to deploy on the first day. That sounds like a great process to keep a remote team working. You've said before that iteration is easier remote, but innovation is easier in person. What does that mean?
What I try to explain with this is a little bit nuanced, because when I say innovation, I don't mean doing innovative stuff. Every startup, every team, every knowledge worker does innovative stuff. Otherwise, you wouldn't succeed. You can't just do what everybody else is doing. It is exactly the same way. You need to do something smarter, better, cheaper, faster, whatever. You need to be innovative by default. So I don't mean being innovative. I mean innovation in the sense of we need to fundamentally change our business. You know, we need to make a huge pivot. We need to change how we manage. We need to launch a new product. We need to do our quarterly planning, and we need to hit new revenue goals, and we have no fucking idea how to do that. This kind of stuff tends to be a little bit easier in in-person discussions, because there's a lot of nuance that you lose in a Hangout call. There is a lot of, especially with complicated topics, it's hard to do them in a Hangout call, because it becomes like two people talking, three people listening in a way, you know. It's sometimes you can like pre-structure through documents that everybody can read, that's fine, you know, but there's still a lot of nuance that you lose. So I highly recommend even remote teams to meet, let's say, every quarter at least. One thing that I personally prefer is actually having teams within the remote company to meet more often than that. So like basically fly together for kickoffs or fly together for whatever, right? Because it becomes at some point when you're like 30 people, 50 people each, like meet becomes really complex to arrange. And at that time, you shouldn't waste it with like project discussions. You should actually use it to get to know each other, right? So even remote teams need this in FaceTime. So innovation there is like by far better. On the other hand, iteration, in my opinion, is by far better remote. If I can optimize my day for my own performance and not for being sure that I have enough FaceTime with Sandra of the office, because Sandra doesn't like me and tries to fire me and like constantly nitpicks when I don't arrive on time, this is by far better for my productivity. I can bring my kids to school, right? And I can afterwards go to the gym, and then I start working, and then maybe I take a break and read a book that I want to read, and then I get my kids from school, and then I do dinner for everybody, and then I work 4 hours at night. And I know people who do this schedule, right? And I know people who do completely different schedules, but like optimized for their own performance. I can optimize my own performance. Like I work maybe from a special room at home that I optimize just for work, or I go to a small office of people I like working with, and I optimize this place for my own performance. You know, I personally believe in a few years from now, it will be almost ridiculous for us that we expected high performance engineers to adapt to whatever weird framework we have, you know, and just like come and adapt this framework instead of them owning their own performance outcomes, you know, instead of them owning their own schedule and their well-being and their health and happiness. You know, we were like, no, we actually want you to come to the office and be like miserable in the afternoon because that's the time where you would love to take a nap, but you can't, right? Instead of that, we were like, come to the office, and like, instead of that, it would be just like, of course, you're like one of the best engineers in your field, and you're like highly productive, and you want to own your own performance and productivity. Like, holy fuck, of course. So innovation better in person, iteration better remote is kind of the summary I'm trying to have with that.
That makes sense. One question. It sounded like some of the cases you, so like time shifting. My guess is there are some co-located teams that are very pro-time shifting. You know, they don't have standardized time. I know there are also remote teams that are very strict about time overlap. It's more synchronous because maybe they're not cross time zones. Do those things really go hand in hand, like remote and time shifting and co-located and synchronous time?
So in remote teams, there's almost like this cultural spectrum from sync to async. Meaning, for example, Envision is a company valued, I think, at $1.3 billion or some crazy number.
They're doing all right.
Fully remote. But they expect everybody to work on Eastern time. So even if you are based in West Coast or in, Europe, they expect you to work on Eastern time. This obviously doesn't work for a lot of people because, you know, you're basically shifting your whole day schedule, right? And most remote teams I know try to have an overlap of like 5 hours of synchronous time, right? Doesn't mean that you constantly work together, but like being able to roughly have the same time where you know you could ping somebody and they would instantly, or like within reasonable time, reply, right? So for example, at Product Hunt, we used to hire, and we still hire, between West Coast and Eastern Europe. This includes Latin America and Africa. And this was like a huge spectrum of time, but it comes down to if you expect people in the East Coast to get up early and expect people West Coast to get up early and in Eastern Europe to stay a little bit later, everybody has like roughly a reasonable working frame of time, but has like enough overlap, right? I know teams that are fully asynchronous. I know teams that intentionally try to have no hiring limitation and like work completely asynchronous. Most synchronous team companies I know have their individual teams synchronized. So they have like the mobile team in Indonesia or like in the Indonesian time zone, roughly, you know, an Asian time zone, maybe. They have their marketing team in American time zone and so on and so on, right? So even this is what I'm saying, it's a spectrum. So even like within asynchronous team companies, a lot of them have synchronous teams. And then there is like the extreme case, as I mentioned before, like of asynchronous teams, like Doist, that has an expectation that everything is asynchronous. You know, like if you write something, you don't expect people to instantly reply, but you expect them when they reply to have a thought through answer. So it's a little bit of a different thinking. And this is almost like a spectrum. And most discussions around the future of remote work aren't so much like, will we work in future remote, which is like, to me, like a no-brainer, because the internet is not going away. Like we will work more online, we work more internationally, this won't change. So the question is not so much like, will we work remotely, but it will be much more like, how synchronous will we work? And that will be more like the spectrum where the discussion will happen, in my opinion.
So let's say I'm leading an engineering team, we raised the Series A, so we've mostly gotten by on network hiring locally. I am excited about remote, and I'm thinking about this synchronous, asynchronous spectrum. What are some of the things that I should consider when I'm deciding how I want to structure or how I want to move my culture?
Yes. So hybrid teams of like you have people in the office and you have people remote are naturally a little bit hard to do. The reason is if I'm in the office, it's very easy for me to just talk to somebody, you know, and it's very complicated for me to write something down. In a remote team, it's very, very not even complicated, annoying to speak to somebody because it's like, hey, have you taken for a hangout? And then like, yeah, sure, hangout. And then maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. But like anything longer than 30 minutes is like a pain for everybody, right? So it's a little bit more annoying to have to talk to somebody in a sense, you know, but it's really, really easy to write something properly down. And you actually start to make this like, it's actually enjoyable. Like you start like just writing your thoughts you draft like your whole thoughts, and then at some point it becomes natural for you to writing down your whole thoughts before a meeting so that everybody can read them instead of you just articulating, right? So this becomes very natural, but it's very different. It's almost like it's different communication layer that just acts differently. It's not one is better than the other, it's just like different, right? And both have to do more of the other, blah, blah, blah. But in a hybrid team, the problem that you have is that one part of the team acts on one layer and the other will act on the other layer. So if you have a critical amount of people in the office and like a few poor souls not in the office, these people will constantly expect communication layer that's really annoying and hard for the other group, you know? So these people will feel isolated. So how do you get around this? Let's assume you still want to have the hybrid setup. Like, of course, you could say like everybody works in a remote, everybody is happy and we live joyful, fairy tale, blah, 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 you know? Let's assume this is not reality. Like, let's say, assume you want to keep the office or you have to keep the office for whatever reason. You can segment. You can say, for example, this team here is now remote first. There is a special unit in our team that, for example, focuses on one large area of the company. They do, for example, the mobile app or they do whatever, right? And this whole team, there's like the whole engineering team in the office might be 20 people, but in this team, there's only two. And there is three more actually remote. All of a sudden, this team has a almost like a critical amount of people remote, you know, and it becomes to the point that this team can act like remote first. It's very, very normal for companies to have segment of their company remote. It's traditionally it's the sales team, you know, like you have a sales team that like visits clients or you have a sales team that has like some part in this city and you have like some salesperson in that city or whatever, right? It's by default sales is the natural form, like it's very natural to remote. Another one is nowadays customer care. Like Shopify has more than 1,000 people working remote in their customer care team. So this team acts like as if it would be a remote team in a company that's technically not a remote company, right? So segmentation is a very healthy one. The other one is, and also like the good thing about segmentation is you start learning patterns and behavior that you should incorporate in the whole company to just make it easier to make more and more people work remote. And so you're starting to learn in a more or less like testing area. So this would be my number one recommendation. There's a few nuanced extra ones. For example, make sure that remote people come to the office to meet everybody regularly, and then ideally not make them come to the office, but make everybody go somewhere else, you know, and this kind of stuff, you know. Or another would could be give the this, if you have like remote people, like give them as much authority as possible. Another hack is if you really want to force remote behavior is trying to have the people that people have to report to being remote. So like all of a sudden it changes how you need to communicate, you know, like you can't just go to the, like you're not preferred because you're next to the boss. The boss is also remote, right? So there's a few hacks and little nuances you can do, but the primary one would be segmentation to me.
So if I'm in that Series A, I know that my CEO is not going to be excited about going fully remote. I could say our mobile app or our data pipeline or some other big piece.
Or the classical one is infrastructure. Like that's the most classical one. Like, hey, we have two DevOps people that are remote, right? And they are like poor souls, you know, but on the other hand, they are on two different time zones, so therefore they have like almost like a natural overlap and somebody of them will be roughly online, you know. And we have like, it was like DevOps is like a classical case of that, you know. I wouldn't recommend it personally because it tends to be very isolating. But another one is like, as you said, mobile. It can be it's very healthy if you don't segment by technology, for example. You don't say like DevOps and mobile, you say more like by goals and outcomes. So you have like one team that's around customer engagement, or like one team about resurrection and like all this kind of stuff. And then you create a team there, and that's usually healthier.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we provide world-class developer screening for high-growth teams, but I'm one of the founders, so it's possible that I'm a little biased. Instead of taking it from me, I think you should hear from our customers' candidates. Here's a real quote from a real software engineer about our work simulations and the feedback we deliver. I just completed my Woven assessment, and I had a blast doing it. What a great tool! By far the most fair and effective technical interview experience I've had from the interviewee side of the table. If you want to judge for yourself, we'd be happy to build you a tailored demo that you can play with on your own time. Go to woventeams.com/demo to get started. That's woventeams.com/demo. So let's switch gears and talk about hiring in a maybe a distributed context. So when I talk to folks in especially smaller markets, the number one complaint is always, I have no candidates. I basically have none. When I talk to folks that are hiring remotely, they don't have that problem. What's different about remote hiring?
I get the arrogance of expecting to be having a lot of engineers if you're like in San Francisco. I get that, right? Or like in Silicon Valley. Sure, why not? But if you're like in a small town, or like in a, even if it's like a major city in America that has like less than 1 million people, why do you expect the best people of the world to live there? Like statistically speaking, the majority of the world is not in the city where you live, period, you know, by a fact of billions. So period, it's you're fishing in a small pond. And if the small pond has like another other interesting startups to work on, like, holy shit. Like it gets to the point, like I regularly invest or advise people to invest. And I talk to startups like, you are launching in San Francisco and you're trying to build up your engineering team here. And I don't see this to be like the hip shit every engineer wants to work on, because it's like their fucking career boost. You know, like if you work on a really technically complex product, it has a good career boost. Like you can go to Google and afterwards everywhere, right? So how do you expect actually to hire people? And more importantly, how do you expect them to retain them? Because if you have to rehire every 1.5 years, your whole hiring process is like fucked, you know? Like you can't build up anything in the team. And that's the default in San Francisco, you know? That's the default if you're good, you know? That's not the default if you're like break out, like you're just starting and nobody knows about you and your product is like not really interesting. It's just like whatever, right? What the fuck are you doing?
There's a lot of interest in, there's a lot of interesting things where you can make an impact in San Francisco.
Exactly. And the truth, honestly, this is true for almost every city, right? So remote, you just have a bigger pond to fish in, as Matt Mullenweg says. That being said, it's not necessarily easier just because you have more candidates. You can be a little bit more pickier, which is very often fine, you know, but it's still a very highly involved process. Like most remote teams that I know have people hired full-time just for hiring, you know, because it's a very involved process. If you have, and for example, at Product Hunt, we used to have several hundred applicants for each job after 1 or 2 days. And we were like, okay, I'm cutting this job after 4 days, because I know it's freaking unfair, because like, you might not have heard about it. You might not, like you're considering it, you're preparing your shit, and now it's like the job is gone, what the fuck, you know? But I can't deal with more than 400 or 500 applicants in this now, like, and I will reopen it maybe, you know, I don't know, but holy shit. And this was a regular scenario for us. And I know companies you most likely don't even know that are bootstrapped, 30 people, another one that's like 40, 50 people. They get 1,000 applicants per month for like 2 to 3 jobs. You know, if a larger, well-known remote company like Doist opens up a role in a non-engineering role, like customer care, right? They get realistically more than 1,000 applicants. Not all of them good. Not all of them perfect, not all of them matching, you know, but it's at least a start. Like having 1,000 applicants is, exactly, having 1,000 applicants is better than not having 1,000 applicants, right?
Other than hiring someone to do full-time hiring, what do you do as an engineering leader? And you've got 100, 200, 300 applicants, you can close the job early, but then you still have that pool. What do you have to change versus someone that has way fewer applicants?
Automate what you can automate. There's stuff you can just automate with good tooling. Another one is know what you want and ask good questions up front. And asking those questions up front becomes a form of art.
Like on the application itself?
Yes, absolutely. And ask them up front, first thing people do, right? one company I highly admire, it's called Zapier. They got this down to a freaking form of art. If you read the application form of Zapier, the questions, it honestly feels somewhere between YC application and soul searching. And it's to this point where you have to not only think about like what is the question, but what is the question behind the question they're actually trying to get at, and what is the question behind the question behind the question? You know, one that stuck with me was for engineering managers was what kind of archetypes of developers are out there, and which one do you think you are the most, and which one do you like working most with? And I'm like, how the fuck do I answer that? You know, like, how do you answer that with, like, there's like questions behind the question behind the question. Like, is the correct answer saying, I believe everybody is unique? Or is the correct answer saying like, hey, there's these kind of archetypes? Or is the correct answer saying like, no, I believe more there's different kinds of behavioral patterns, you know, or like phases in life? Like, how the freaking frack do you start answering this question? And then like, which one am I? And then it's getting like, holy shit, like, what do you want from me? So asking good questions upfront is absolute must. One more that I highly recommend is if you hire internationally and for some reason your network is exhausted, you know, CVs tend to be a little bit complicated because you don't necessarily know, like, you get this applicant from India and he worked for some, like, he went to some university that's called like ITT or something like that. You have never heard about it, you know, like, what the hell does it mean, you know? Turns out it's one of the best universities in the world, but you have never heard about it. So how do you deal with that, right? And that's hard work. That's, again, tooling. And AngelList offers some tools and their hiring process for that. But it's just hard work. Another one here is, at least for me as a non-native speaker, if somebody speaks to me as a native speaker, they automatically sound more intelligent. They're eloquent, you know, they are precise, they're on point. You know, and they just sound smart, like those people I hear all the time in the podcast, you know. But if somebody comes like who has an accent like me, you know, and had struggles like finding the right words to put into sentences, you know, it's like a little bit, I'm not saying he sounds stupid, but I'm a little bit biased automatically. And I realized it at some point, because what I did, and I highly recommend this every engineering manager to do, is I did pair programming with every candidate that I pre-filtered. And pair programming in the sense of, I sent you an application, you get it to run locally, you prove this that you got it like to run locally somehow, maybe you like you sent back some result or something, and then we jump on a call and I give you a challenge in this one application that you already know now, that you have like played with, that you understand, and we together work on this challenge. And it's a real world application problem. So for example, at Product Hunt, it used to be a mini version of Product Hunt. At AngelList venture, it is and used to be something, I mean, I don't know if I can spoil this, but like something around working with really large data sets of I can't even properly explain it right now, but like basically with a complex structures in investments. This is like the summary, right? In CoinList, it was one around ICO offerings and so on and so on, right? It's like a real thing that if you actually do that well and you enjoy it, you most likely learned what kind of work we do. And by watching people pair programming and helping them through the challenge and like hearing what questions they have and how they solve them and all this kind of stuff, you learn by far more than by talking a technical interview or doing whiteboarding or asking them some hypothetical questions, because that just tests how good are they in English and how long when did they go to university and literally nothing else, right? Pair programming is one of the most underestimated and not enough utilized aspects of hiring that we have out there, and not enough people do it. And in a remote team, in my opinion, you're forced to do it almost.
My guest today has been Andreas Klinger. Andreas, thank you for joining us on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Andreas for sharing his experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, metrics should be used for de-risking, not politics. There's a strong drive to follow the A-B testing mantra of Google and these big services that have millions of users and lots of data. When we use metrics in our startups, we need to ask, what are we using this metric for? Is it for internal politics? Are we trying to prove that what we did matter? Or are we actually going to make a decision? If we're going to make a decision whether we launch a feature or change something, that's a pretty good use for metrics. If we're just putting metrics in to show how good we did, maybe it's a waste. Early on in our product process, metrics are especially alluring and maybe not as helpful. We don't really have much to compare against. We don't really have a lot of users. Qualitative feedback can be much more useful in those scenarios. Number two, remote teams scale, but they do have distinct administrative needs. There are plenty of benefits to remote work. If we can build an organizational structure that makes remote teams successful, we will scale much more effectively. We can double from 10 to 20 to 40. In person, it's easy to just hold an impromptu meeting. Hey, come over here. Remote, it's really hard. That means we need to develop more mature processes early. When we say process, Andreas means explicit expectations. It's not you need to go through these three layers to make a decision. It is here are the decisions that you are empowered to make by yourself, and here's what you should consider. Remote teams also need to think consciously about time shifting. This is something that all companies eventually have to deal with as they open multiple offices. But if you're remote, you need to think about what are our core hours? When do we want people to be online? If we have people in Eastern Europe and people on the West Coast of the US, that's a challenge. It also may be unrealistic to expect to build a fully co-located team. The reality is most of the world is not in our city. It's a big world. Number three, action and documentation are the keys to great onboarding. Manuals can be good, actually. Good manuals are explicit about what's good and why it works. Why do we do this thing? Good manuals are also up to date. It is often better to have a shorter manual that doesn't cover quite as much than to have a longer manual that's out of date instantly. We should think about what manual can we maintain and who should maintain it. Andreas says that new hires should be making changes to these documents on their first day. Ideally, they should also ship code, maybe, you know, a mouse over, a little bit of tiny UI flourish. And they should also change our onboarding docs again on the very first day. Thanks again to Andreas for coming on the show. Now I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. This will help others find our community. Until next week, keep on scaling.